The following program is a sports handicapping show. That's right, we will be discussing sports betting and all kinds of other gambling stuff, including game predictions. As you know, not every bet will win, but we do our best. Feel free to use this information at your own risk, and remember, wager wisely, folks.
Broadcasting from the Vegas Video Network studios, live from the Las Vegas Strip, Covers.com presents Vegas Sports Day. And now from the sports betting capital of the world, here are your hosts, Teddy and the Professor.
It's Tuesday in Sin City, and you are watching Vegas Sports Day, the pulse of the sports betting world. I'm your host, Teddy Covers, joined, as always, by my colleague, the professor, Dave Malinsky.
Coming up today, you could be committing a handicapping cardinal sin if you're not adjusting one team's defense properly. Why tonight's bowl game in St. Petersburg might actually resemble a high school reunion. And even though leap year may still be 2 weeks away, we're going to adjust our calendar today. In money time, it's Thursday, not Tuesday.
All right, Dave. First take following a Monday's worth of action. We had Monday Night Football last night, college hoops, and of course, a little bit of NBA that you might want to talk about. What's your first take?
A little bit of NBA that should have been a lot of NBA. And one of the difficulties we have is my own particular approach is a little bit on the conservative side. And when a situation emerges in an NBA preseason game, there's only so far that you can go with it. Yesterday's show, we talked about the Clippers against the Lakers. We didn't play nearly enough. That unfolded exactly the way that you would have think it would have. The Clippers wanted the game. They brought the right focus. They're so much further advanced than the Lakers right now. But when you see a game that one-sided, you have to look at both elements. Yes, the Clippers looked good. And they may assimilate better than a lot of people would expect. When you talk about guys like Chris Paul and Chauncey Billups, first note that point guards assimilate better than in any other position. Because you're used to doing so many different things on a basketball court, working around different players. Second is Billups actually, at this stage in his career, might be better at the number two spot than a point guard. But maybe more than anything else, it's a Laker issue. You're really going to miss Lamar Odom. One of the reasons why Odom meant so much to that team is you were so weak at point guard. Derek Fisher and Steve Blake, are there a weaker point guard combination anywhere in the NBA? So they relied on Odom to pick up the slack for those two. It's going to be an awkward opening to the season for the Lakers, and we can't wait to see how the odds makers try to price tomorrow's rematch, same court, same teams, this time with the Clipper fans holding most of the tickets. Teddy, your first take on a Tuesday morning.
Well, we got to talk about the 49ers and what they did last night to Pittsburgh, completely dominating the Steelers at the line of scrimmage, getting in Ben Roethlisberger's face on defensive play after defensive play, finally finding a way to get some red zone touchdowns instead of settling for field goals. And then, of course, once the lead grew to three scores in the fourth quarter, man, the hits, those 49ers guys in the secondary, the cornerbacks and safeties were laying on Pittsburgh's receivers. They looked pretty good last night. And I know all the hype so far in the NFC this year has really come on Green Bay and New Orleans, and deservedly so. Those two teams have both put up monstrous offensive numbers. They have MVP-caliber quarterbacks in terms of Aaron Rodgers and Drew Brees, who are probably going to go 1-2 in the MVP voting again this year. And we've seen the Packers and the Saints on national TV a lot this year. But I know that both you and I, Dave, were able to cash a ticket on Sunday night with the San Diego Chargers beating up on the Baltimore Ravens. And I genuinely think there is legitimate East Coast bias when it comes to some of these point spreads and some of these situations. The Niners haven't gotten any hype. They've been, oh, yeah, they're a nice story, but Alex Smith isn't going to be able to do it. Alex Smith was great last night. Against Pittsburgh's defense, he was on the money, and the mistakes that were made in the San Fran passing game had more to do with drop passes and big hits from the Steelers secondary than it did to anything that San Francisco did wrong. I like this Niners team. I think they match up very well with both potential favorites. When you look at the way Vic Fangio's defense is playing right now, they got the best defense in the NFC. That makes them live, in my mind, once the postseason begins. Let's shift focus to MarketWatch, Dave. And we've gotten a couple of letters, a couple of emails. There was a forum post. There was a tweet. people are asking about consensus numbers and public betting. They were very interested in the notion of fading the public. Is that a strategy that works in 2011/2012, or is that something that's a little bit outdated? And I think the question itself is a good one to discuss here. Thanks for the emails, guys. We're going to talk about it right here at the top in MarketWatch. So, Malinsky, is it worth fading the public? Is that concept still in play in 2011?
We bring that up because you're going to see a lot of line moves in the bowl games in the weeks ahead. So you're going to see opportunities that aren't there now that will show up later. TCU opens 10.5 in a bowl game tomorrow night, down to 9.5. That could go to 8. It could go back up to 10.5 or 11. So you want to be ready to pounce when you get to the right price point. But let's see what some misconceptions here. You will hear a lot of people sitting in chairs like we're sitting in here will say, you can make money by fading the public. And I've never quite understood that. I mean, I understand what they're trying to sell to you because it's a good marketing gimmick. But the notion that you can make money fading the public, well, first, who's the public? How do you define that? Second, if you've been on the other side of the counter and you look at the numbers that the sportsbooks generate, the idea that, well, we're going to fade the publics on this thing, we'll fade them and we'll win. No, the public doesn't lose because they're wrong. They lose because they're laying 11 to 10. If you're going to fade them and win fading them, that means they've got to be picking, you know, in that mid 40% range or a little bit higher in order for you to overcome the 11 to 10 going against them. So there are some components here that we've never quite understood. The public is not that sophisticated in some aspects, but boy, that's changed a lot. You know, in the last 10 years, the average $50 to $100 bettor has access to so much information they didn't have access to. I think the public's sharper now than they ever were before. So I hear people say that notion, fade the public and you'll win. When I ask them to explain it back to me, no one's ever done it yet in a way that makes any sense.
Yeah, Dave, and when I first moved to Vegas, my first football season out here was 1998, and that was a mantra, was beaten into my head by the guys I looked up to and the people I was listening to at the time. And you're just learning your craft, what's important, don't get on public teams. And that was a huge issue at that stage. And frankly, in the late 90s, it was still a money-winning strategy. And you could look at the covers consensus and say, wow, this road favorite, 77% of the public likes them. I'm going to automatically go the other way. And at the end of the year, you'd show a profit from those type of results. But to equate the betting marketplace in 2011 with the betting marketplace in 1998 is like equating yourself, saying, oh, I'm the same as when I was an 8-year-old boy as I am as a 22-year-old man. It's changed completely over the course of the last decade and a half. And that means a significantly more influence of sharp money, significantly more influence from betting syndicates, significantly more influence from computer-generated number. The public's a non-factor when it comes to setting numbers. The public's a non-factor when it comes to moving point spreads. Maybe with your local bookie, who doesn't get any sharp action, yeah, he's got to adjust his point spread based on solely public action. But when we look around the big sports books in the world, both here in Vegas and offshore, there isn't one book out there that's adjusting the number based on public money. It's how the sharps are going to bet and trying to get on the best of the $1,000 and $5,000 and $10,000 bets. They could give two hoots about the $50 or $100 better. They're going to win their money long term, as you mentioned, Dave, taking advantage of the long the juice that builds up even when a capper is going 50-50.
Yeah, if we've got some old-timers watching the show, there's a phrase that some of you will remember, emanated back in the 70s and carried on even into the early 80s, was the cookie count. Now, back at that time, you had a lot of action on parlay cards, you know, around the U.S., and there were some big bookmakers that had huge distribution networks on those. Now, parlay cards, of course, are a little different beast in that you're intentionally shading the line to beat the smaller bettor, knowing that they're probably going to lay the worst of it anyway. At that point in the 70s and 80s, tend to see the public a lot more on favorites than on underdogs. So you see a lot of favorites that we had shaded. So here comes the cookie count on Sunday. And what that was is you looked at the three teams that were the most popularly played on the parlay cards. And the funny thing is it was a slow grind to play against them back at that point. It shows how the public was falling for certain little situations. But now so much has changed. Now, if you talk to some sportsbook directors out here or even offshore, they'll say, public not only is smarter, but the betting patterns have changed. One reason why they played favorites a lot in the 70s and 80s, not every game was on television. So you knew more about the good teams and the bad teams. You read more articles. You saw them play a little bit more. So naturally, you were going to bet the known versus the unknown. Well, now it's 2011. The public can bet an underdog. They can bet an under instead of always betting overs on these totals because they see all the games. They can know as much about the New England Patriots or Arizona Cardinals as the New England Patriots. Every NFL team gets coverage. Every team is on TV. Remember some of Teddy's rants about Jacksonville being on Monday Night Football. So the knowledge base is out there. So this notion that you can win by bucking the public, yeah, it was true once upon a time. But if someone is telling you that now, they're just trying to sell you something.
Well,
that's true.
Well, that being said, Dave, I do look at the coverage consensus. And I look at it in an effort to get me off of plays, not get me on. What I'm interested, 80%. You know, when you see 80% of the public liking a team, particularly a road favorite, that's enough to get me off a game that I might have been involved with otherwise. But looking at the coverage consensus is never going to get me on a game that I might, you know, I was kind of on the fence and I see the consensus, oh, yeah, this is the one. It's not going to happen. It'll get you off some of those public sides, but it's not going to put me on. It's not going to get me to get my money to the betting window. And Dave alluded to something earlier on in this Market Watch segment, talking about how a better method of choosing some plays, of finding some value, is to look at some of the late point spread moves. Take advantage of the numbers moving in different directions. Take advantage of whether it's public or sharp money coming in on one side or another, and all of a sudden a plus 11 becomes a plus 14, and a plus 14, guess what? That's a strike price. That's a playable bet, whereas it wasn't at plus 11. So you can take advantage of some of these line moves, particularly as we get close to kickoff and you see the numbers really starting to bounce around. In my mind, that's a much better way. Fade the money. Don't fade the public.
So as we break down the bowls for you, and we will do every bowl game from here till LSU-Alabama comes in, we'll talk about what those strike points could be because, again, there will be some forced action. Florida International Marshall tonight, the books are going to write good business. Put that same game on a Saturday afternoon in the middle of October, they're going to have trouble writing anything at all. There's going to be forced action on some of these lesser games. We may find some bargains along the way.
And I hope we've been able to answer the emails that came in appropriately here in this Market Watch segment. If we didn't, hey, let us know. Send us an email, sportsday@covers.com. You can follow us on Twitter. Send us questions that way, @VegasSportsDay. And, of course, if you're not involved in the Covers.com community right now, you're really missing out. Active threads and discussions going right now, Covers.com/postingforum.
When we come back, you should always wear a hat when you're on the beach to protect against the sun. But is a fedora the right choice? You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Are you looking for the latest odds, the fastest scores, the most important trends, and the best matchups and stats? Are you looking for the key late-breaking information that can make you a winner? Well, Covers.com has the answer. The world's largest sports betting community gives you a front-row seat in the heart of the action, from the opening lines to the final scores. If you want to stay ahead of the game, Covers covers the numbers.
This is David Ivey from Pub Crawl. It's funny because this is David from. You should just leave it on. Hi, I'm David Ivey from Pub Crawl, and you're watching the Vegas Video Network. And scene.
Okay, guys, time to scrub up. Let's get those surgical gloves on. It's time for the postmortem, where we take you deep inside the game to show you the things you should have seen, but probably didn't.
You know, when I read the list of teams that were still alive for a playoff berth yesterday, the Arizona Cardinals were on that list. Yes, this is the same Arizona Cardinals that opened up the season 1-6, a team that had four losses by 4 points or less during that span. So if we cut the season in half at 14 games where we are right now, consider the last seven to be the second half of the season, boom, here's Arizona. They're 6-1 over their last seven ballgames. The only loss during that span came at San Francisco, and certainly nothing wrong with that. And we already talked about how good the Niners are. And let's not forget that Arizona won the rematch between those two teams 3 weeks later. So has any team ever had this type of a run late in the season in the NFL and gotten less hype? We certainly aren't seeing any John Skeleton skits on Saturday Night Live You compare Denver 6-1 with Arizona 6-1, and the national noise that Denver's gotten, Arizona dead silent. You can hear crickets when people are talking about the Cardinals these days. You know, they certainly still have issues at quarterback. Skelton, QB rating 66.8, more interceptions than touchdowns. They've had problems in the red zone, and yet there's something maybe that indicates this Arizona run is real, at least in some way, Dave.
2011 has been a much different football season. You had less time in training camp, particularly a difficult time for teams with new coordinators having to make adjustments. And here's where the Arizona story comes. Because if we were on the air back in August, we could have set this up. Not so much that this would have been a good example that would have turned out this well, but it's one that's been unique to follow along. And it's actually been frustrating for some of us. Got a close friend who lives in Scottsdale who has Arizona Cardinals license plates. Now, you can decide whether that's tacky or not amongst yourselves. Some of us think it's a little tacky. But it was fun for so much of the season to be able to send these little emails out as the Cardinals fell behind every Sunday. Hey, remember tomorrow when you go to work, you have to back in to your parking place. Don't want anyone to see that. Or if someone sees you at the supermarket, say, oh, no, those are the St. Louis Cardinals. Tony La Russa is my uncle. Well, we've lost all those jokes of late. Because the Cardinals are winning, they're winning with defense. Here was the problem early in the season. Ray Horton was the new defensive coordinator. Ray Horton is a guy we like an awful lot. But he had a couple of rookies starting on defense, and he was trying to package in new schemes at a time where they just weren't ready to do it. Now watch them unfold. In that 6-1 streak, they've given up 8 touchdowns. That's number 2 in the NFL in that span. Third down conversion rate, number 2 in the NFL in that span. It's coming together. So here's a progression of quotes that we take from Horton that helps us set this up. Now, this first quote, note the timing of it. This is 3 weeks ago. This is before they beat Dallas and San Francisco back-to-back and then beat Cleveland on Sunday, talking about the tactical adjustments they were being able to make. That it just took us a while to get it. It's going to be fun because they want to be good and they want to come after people, and we're going to come after them. I now have supreme confidence to call anything on my list. If you go back to the Seattle game, which was week 3, there was nothing on our list to call. So that shows how Horton is seeing the progression before the best part of the streak sets in. Now take a look after Sunday's win. We are finally now to the point where I trust this and the players understand the system enough to where we can put the whole package in. Right now, you have to account for everybody on the field. Earlier in the season, you didn't have to account for everybody, probably just 51, referring to linebacker Paris Lennon. And that was it. Now you have to count for all 11. Every position on the team has a sack. Now, they're the only team in the NFL we can say that about. That shows you how these Horton schemes have really been a big part of what's going on. Yeah, there have been some weak offenses in that span. Bottom line is we've got a defensive coordinator out there that we like a lot. You've got a couple of rookies starting, Sam Acho at linebacker, Patrick Peterson in the secondary, potentially could develop into Pro Bowlers. What's happening in Arizona is pretty darn good right now. But in the NFL, if you win with defense, sometimes teams don't step up and notice. Now time to go out to Hawaii with Larry Fedora, a trip we weren't sure we'd be making with him. When we talked about it on Insider Six Pack 2 weeks ago, when Southern Miss chose to play this particular bowl game, a lot of it was on Fedora's shoulders. He said he wanted the best reward for his players, so why not a trip out to Honolulu for the week instead of some bowls closer to campus? A bit controversial at the time because Southern Miss will lose money on this trip. Not a lot, but even after Conference USA kicks in, because they've got a few other teams in bowls as part of their sharing, yeah, they're going to lose money on the trip. So now Fedora gets hired to go to be the North Carolina coach. At the same time, you're saying, okay, we want our kids to take this trip because it's the best thing for them. Well, I'm going to leave and go coach somewhere else. There's a bit of awkwardness comes into play. But something different's happening with Southern Miss that doesn't happen for most of these bowl scenarios when a coach takes another job. Fedora is going to make the trip out to Honolulu. This is a little bit different than we're accustomed to seeing. Teddy, are they making the right move in keeping a coach in charge that has already possibly jilted the players at the altar?
Well, I mean, Fedora's saying all the right things. Here's his quote. We want to see this thing through. We want to finish this thing. This could be the only team in 100 years of football, Southern Miss football, that wins 12 games. We want to get that 12th win. And, you know, it would have been one thing for Southern Miss to play under Fedora while a new coach had been hired and is involved recruiting right now. But The team left for the islands without the new hire being made. It might not be till January before Southern Miss has a new head coach. It's easier for upperclassmen to deal with this, but when you're talking about freshmen who don't know if there's going to be a scheme change, don't know if they should be thinking about transferring, don't know how the new coaching staff is going to react to them, there are issues. Here's a quote from freshman wide receiver Chris Briggs that speaks volumes about the uncertainties around the Southern Miss program right now. Briggs says, quote, "It comes to mind a lot for me as a freshman. I've been thinking about it the whole week, and I've kind of let it affect me. I've got to stay focused, and I've got to understand it's out of my control." That's even tougher in a place like Hawaii when you talk about distractions, off-field issues, that sort of thing. How do you maintain the focus of your players in this type of environment, especially since all of a sudden, you know, do they actually have to listen to Vidora when it comes to curfews and discipline and that sort of thing? Not so much. He's going to be gone. The new coach will come in with a clean slate. So distractions galore for Southern Miss. Curfew issues, perhaps. You know, this is the type of game that maybe you hear about some suspensions prior to kickoff. But it's also worth noting that Southern Miss starting quarterback Austin Davis got down on his knee at halftime of their basketball game versus Ole Miss on Saturday afternoon. He proposed to longtime girlfriend Heather Edmonds, the former Southern Miss cheerleader, in a scene that reminded some of what Ian Johnson did for Boise State following their remarkable BCS come-from-behind overtime win against Oklahoma a few years back. So the difference, of course, is that Davis got engaged before his bowl game, Johnson after, and that could be one more distraction or one more player on Southern Miss that's not fully focused on the task at hand.
When we come back, no distractions at all. The news you need to know in our Insider Six-Pack.
Hey, I'm Al Mann.
Is that how you get them to do that all the time? Just sit there and be an ass. Is that it?
Hey, I'm Al. Hey, I'm Al Mancini at Top of the Food Chain. You are watching the Vegas Video Network. We got big forks, big spoons. I got a big mouth. I got no guests.
Livestream is your premier place to watch live events on the web, mobile devices, and connected TVs. See new events daily or broadcast your own at livestream.com. Livestream. Be there.
Yeah, I know it's before noon on a Tuesday. Doesn't mean you can't pop the top on your beer as we open up our Insider Six-Pack. Let's start off. We talked about yesterday on the show some of the things that teams are doing to try to draw some crowd support throughout the holiday season. When the students are off campus, many teams are moving their games to an urban venue. We've seen games in Chicago. We've seen games in L.A. We've seen games all over the place. Tonight, we've got one in Rochester. St. Bonaventure moving the game from Olean to Rochester. Yeah, it's 121 miles between the Bonnies' home court and where they're playing this evening. What's the name of the arena? The Blue Cross Arena in Rochester. 121 miles, which sounds like a long way, but at the same time, we talk about the number of St. Bonnie's grads living in the Rochester area versus the number living around campus. They're going to draw for this game. In fact, they drew 5,285 for their game last year against Virginia Tech. That was an overtime loss, a game where the Bonnies played well but came up a little bit short at the end. And when we talk about that 5,285 fans last year, well, consider this. On their home court in the 2011/12 season, the biggest crowd they've had so far, just 4,425 in their opening game against Cornell.
More on tonight's college basketball, boy. Let's go to Lincoln, Nebraska, look at the Central Michigan game at Nebraska. This is the year that Doc Sadler thought he finally had a deep enough rotation to play the way he wants to play, and it was big. They're moving into the Big Ten now. So they thought they were going to be ready. Now here comes the problem. Two of the three leading top three scorers, both likely to be out again tonight. Jorge Bryan Diaz, bothered by a foot injury. Dylan Talley, playing through a bruised thigh, doesn't figure to play. This is the last dress rehearsal for Nebraska before they not only open Big Ten play, but they open it about the hardest way you could, except for maybe going to Columbus, Ohio. They open against Wisconsin in Madison. That's awfully difficult. So a team that they thought had a lot of depth now is down to six players averaging double-figure minutes. Instead of this being that final dress rehearsal to get up to speed before the Wisconsin game, maybe one that they slog through. Only problem with trying to counter this a little bit, you might think Central Michigan plus the points can hang around. They got to play 3 road games in 5 days. That's a tough travel cycle for this type of team. They're using this cycle to toughen up for MAC games ahead. The actual scoreboard, not that important to Ernie Ziegler tonight.
Yeah, another team looking to toughen up before MAC play begins is Kent State. And in theory, playing 3 games in 3 days in the Athletes in Action tournament in Logan, Utah, might have sounded like a good idea when they scheduled it at the time. Instead, the Golden Flash is going to have to grind it out with a depleted roster right now. 6'11 center Justin Manns, he's not with the team on this trip. Head coach Rob Senderoff, a bit vague about his status. Quote, Manns didn't get arrested, and he's not in any trouble with the law or anything. He's just not with us for this tournament, and we'll meet after Christmas. I would anticipate he'll be back on the team, but we need to set some parameters first. So no big man, no Manns, who's obviously at 6'11", a key low post presence for the Golden Flashes. There's also issues with the senior point guard, Michael Perini. He hasn't been practicing at all during the team's 10-day layoff and is listed as a quote-unquote game-time decision for tonight. Check his status for sure before you get involved in this game.
Time to start clearing up the NFL infirmary reports from this weekend. Chris Johnson suffered a sprained ankle in the fourth quarter for Tennessee at Indianapolis. Looks like he's probable for this week. We're going to give you a quote that's going to say questionable for Mike Munchak, but no bad damage to the ankle, just a mild sprain. Munchak's quote, he'll be questionable this week, but we saw him Monday, and we don't think there's any reason he'll be out for the game, but he is definitely sore. Where Munchak was quiet yesterday was about his quarterback rotation. Now that they're out of the playoffs, is it time for Jake Locker to get 2 games and start building to next year? Or is it going to be Matt Hasselbeck one more time? At this stage, we don't think there's any reason to play Hasselbeck anymore. He's already past peak. He showed on Sunday that he's not really a playoff quarterback anymore. And when next year's training camp comes around, he's not going to be any younger. Probably time for Jake Locker to take over.
Yeah, unless he's got some of those Benjamin Button buttons or something like that to get younger between now and the start of next preseason. Let's talk about the Green Bay Packers offensive line. We brought this up on yesterday's show. Today, we're going to come through with some details. Offensive line injuries, a big concern right now for Green Bay. They've already been without the right tackle, Chad Clifton. He's been out for the better part of the last 2 months. And he doesn't look like is Clifton on IR? I believe he is. He's not coming back anytime soon. Brian Bulaga, the other tackle, was lost with a sprained right kneecap this past weekend. He's not expected to play this week against Chicago. And Bulaga's backup, Derek Sherrod, broke his right leg this past week against KC. He's out for the remainder of the season. So the only true tackle on the entire roster is second-year player Marshall Newhouse. He's been filling in for Clifton, and he's been, let's call him, inconsistent at best. For now, it looks like starting left guard T.J. Lang is going to be moving over to right tackle, and Evan Dietrich Smith will start at left guard. This is from offensive coordinator Joe Philbin. Here's the quote. I'm trying to remember if we've been quite this thin. I know we've done a lot of musical chairs over the years, sub guys in and out, but this is going to be potentially unique. We'll see how it all shakes out here over the next couple days. We might have to be doing some extra tutorials with some guys, no question. Green Bay laying big points against the Bears on Christmas night.
Many times we start a Tuesday show in Market Watch by giving you the fresh lines for the teams coming off the Monday night game. But you may not see one for a while on St. Louis-Pittsburgh. Quarterback issues and other injuries affecting both teams. St. Louis has announced that Sam Bradford has been shut down for the season now. So Kellen Clemens will get the start in the last 2 games. And keep in mind, we've talked about this a few times in Market Watch segments, even in Insider Six-Pack topics. When you're out of the playoffs, the last 2 games of the season, people think, oh, they're going to go flat. They're not going to come to play. Now think about a guy like Kellen Clemens, who's playing for his NFL career right now. Didn't have a bad game against Cincinnati on Sunday. 95.7 passer rating for that game was the best single game a St. Louis quarterback has turned in all year. But when you think it might be a flat team out there on the road, no, Clemens playing for his NFL career, a couple of good outings, he'll find himself invited to a camp next year. For Pittsburgh, could be big decision time for Ben Roethlisberger. If you saw the way he was limping around against San Francisco last night, you see that some rest is required if he's going to be at peak for the playoffs. But now, because you lost that game, Pittsburgh, you're not likely to beat Baltimore out for the division or that first round by an home field advantage in the playoffs. So do you consider maybe sitting Roethlisberger? You might be able to win this game without him anyway. Even if Roethlisberger wouldn't play, Pittsburgh's going to be a double-figure favorite. Is it time for Mike Tomlin to say, you know what, we're going to give you the week off, get healthy again, we need you in the playoffs?
When we come back, our focus turns to bowl season. We're going to go to St. Petersburg after this short break.
Traditional media believes that after about 3 minutes, you'll tune out. Most Vegas media companies think if it doesn't jiggle, you won't tune in. At the Vegas Video Network, we think both are wrong. The Vegas Video Network is the first and only live online broadcast network that specializes in insider news and expert views about Vegas. We combine great storytelling with the ability to watch when and where you want, on your computer, mobile device, or television. Discover the real Las Vegas. Visit VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Okay, guys, it's money time. This edition of Money Time is brought to you by Covers.com. Remember, for all the key information you need in every sport, Covers covers the numbers. Let's start tonight in Spokane, Washington. Butler and Gonzaga is the, feature game on tonight's a college basketball card, a good matchup of mid-majors. The Zags laying 13, this time at home in Spokane, Dave.
This is one we want to get to and probably will before the day's out. And we woke up, we thought it was going to be easier than it's turning out to be. This is a lot of points to take with a team that plays with the discipline that Butler plays at. And you still have a couple of veteran grinders there. Ronald Norad, senior guard, Andrew Smith, now a junior up front. These are guys who've been to Final Fours. They're used to competing in hostile environments. And what an uptick for Butler. At a time when the season was going sour on Saturday, trailing by 15 points against Purdue, rallied to win that game outright. So now here comes the energy level back. Here's a team that'll play smart. They'll guard hard. They'll hit the boards. All the ingredients we usually want when we're taking double figures, except one. They can't make a shot from anywhere. This is an atrocious shooting team. 39% from the field, 28.9 from three-point range, and even 63.2 at the free throw line. Those are very, very ugly numbers. And if you're going to compete against a fundamentally sound Gonzaga team, you're going to have to make the open shots when you get them. So there's the conundrum with Butler tonight. We think, okay, they can hang in. If they get behind, they probably can't shoot their way back in. So we bet the first half instead of the full game, right? Well, even that doesn't work out. They played eight games against Division I opponents so far. They trailed at halftime in all of them, four in double figures. So, Teddy, I want to take the dog plus these points. Can I?
I don't think so. At least I'm not taking the dog, not with my money. And the issue here is twofold. Really, it's threefold. One, this is a statement game for Gonzaga. Butler has gotten to the promised land not once but twice. Remember, the Zags were that first mid-major that kind of cracked the barrier of the NCAA tournament and made people think, all right, mid-majors can hang with the big boys. They never made it to a Final Four. They never made it to a national championship game. Butler's not just done that once. They've done it in each of the last 2 years. So now here's Gonzaga, the program that kind of set the table for all these other mid-majors who've had success. Here's a Gonzaga team playing at home, and they've got something to prove against Butler. They really do, which means that they're not going to be laying off the gas pedal, given the opportunity to run up the score late here. Second issue is that, man, when we look at the Zags front court, they're good. They're dominating the glass. They're getting good looks at the basket from close range. And Butler, they don't have a true center. They don't have a big man that can defend and rebound. This is one game where the Zags likely to win the battle of the boards and the battle of the paint, potentially by a pretty significant margin. And last but not least, you know, coming into the season, my biggest concern about Gonzaga was the play of their young guards. And that was very much on display. They didn't play particularly well over the first month. Well, they're getting better. We've seen the freshmen, Kevin Pangos and Gary Bell, getting better game by game. In fact, they've gotten so much better that all of a sudden Mark Few's in the awkward position of having to sit a kid named Stockton on the bench for longer and longer stretches. That's not John Stockton. It's his son, David. But he got only 13 minutes of playing time in Saturday's win over Arizona.
Let's go to Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg. One of these small out-of-the-way bowl games, it might bring a little more spark than you expect. Florida International right now a 4-point favorite over Marshall, total 48. Some trickles of over starting to come in on that total. Here's where this one gets interesting. Marshall has 26 players from Florida on the roster. Big recruiting base for that program. But they've got 11 kids from the Miami-Dade County area. That means a lot of these players have gone head-to-head in high school. A couple of them are Rakeem Cato, the quarterback for Marshall, and T.Y. Hilton, the best player for Florida International. They were on the same high school team. So a lot of trash talking going on. They did smooth one over a little bit. We like this one from Hilton talking about Cato. He says, watching him grow up to where he is now is just incredible to see him. Very impressive as a true freshman, the things he's been able to accomplish and lead his team to a bowl game. Then the minute that the mic stops, and we're going to kick his you-know-what. So there's going to be a lot of fun on the field tonight. These teams are going to get after each other pretty well. The problem is I'm not sure if we can trust either side of the equation. Marshall, the underdog, needed to win the last two games to go bowling, and they did. But look at them. They beat Memphis, a horrendous Memphis team, by 1 point. And at home against the weak East Carolina team, they had to go to overtime before they could get the job done. Doesn't look like Marshall's ready. Quite ready to be trusted with our money yet.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the losses that Marshall suffered this season. Heck, you look at all the losses that Marshall suffered this season. They were ugly. They did not step up well against bowl teams. You know, we saw them get annihilated. Tulsa beat them by 34. Houston beat them by 35. That's their last two losses to close out the season. But you can go back further than that. They lost by 21 to West Virginia. And remember, that game was called, I believe it was the middle of the third quarter. West Virginia could have won that game by 40. Had it gone the full 60 minutes. They lost by 37 to Ohio U, the same Bobcats team, life and death to beat Wyoming this past weekend. They lost by 20 to Virginia Tech. They lost by 10 to UCF. And they were held to 13 points or less in all of those last four losses that I described. So the offense really never clicked for the Thundering Herd when they were trying to step up in class, hence the struggles against teams like East Carolina and Memphis late in the season. That being said, you know, maybe a distraction here for Florida International. Reports, conflicting reports, shall we say, as to Mario Cristobal's status. Cristobal's the head coach who has absolutely engineered a major turnaround for FIU. The Pittsburgh newspapers were insinuating that perhaps he had interviewed for the Pitt job yesterday. The Florida papers, not so much so. But it's one of those little behind-the-curtain type of things you may want to be aware of for Florida International that doesn't bode well for their chances when trying to win by margin this evening.
So if we have to take it back on the field, where do we go? It's difficult at this price point. But keep in mind, Florida International did go to a bowl game last year, and they won it. They beat Toledo in front of a largely partisan Toledo crowd in Detroit and the big edge of quarterback. Wesley Carroll, a senior, started with Mississippi State earlier in his career, so he's been up against some big-time competition. 14 touchdown passes, only four interceptions, puts him head and shoulders above the Marshall freshman quarterbacks. And also, you know, you got the best player in the field in Hilton, not only as a receiver or a guy who carries the ball from scrimmage, but look at Hilton on special teams. 32 yards per return on kickoff returns this year, 23.3 on punt returns, including a touchdown. Would have led the nation, but most teams just refuse to punt the ball to him. We'll see if Marshall does that tonight. So for our money, if you're in a pool where you have to pick the straight-up winners, yeah, Florida International likely emerges with the win, but are we going to lay points? No, which might explain why when we get to the next edition of Money Time, we move the clock up a little bit, Teddy.
Absolutely. When we come back, we're going to move that clock up and get the jump on what may be some outstanding line value when it comes to Thursday's Texans-Colts NFL matchup.
Oh, hello there. My name is Brandon Gooch Hahn, host of Awkward Silence 2.1. And when I'm not living vicariously through Chris Phillips, I'm on VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Yeah, let's go to Thursday night in Indianapolis. Right now, we're looking at the Houston Texans minus 5.5, total of 40 road favorites in Indy. And Dave, we saw the Colts, I guess, bounce back from the dead this past weekend. Boy, they put the pedal to the metal and destroyed Tennessee, right?
Interesting line when you look at this game right now. When you see a 5.5-point favorite for Houston, which is still fighting for home field advantage and a possible first-round bye in the playoffs. Now, contrast that to this past Sunday where at kickoff, Tennessee, a team out of the playoff hunt, was laying 6.5 on this same field. You got a few injuries involved for Houston, but should Houston be laying a full point less than Tennessee? No, probably should be laying more. But here's what happens in the marketplace when you see extremes. And, yeah, we talked about the cookie count being an old phrase before. How about a DBO or a DBO double 40 phrase? You go back to the 80s when we were coming up with little terms for these sort of things. DBO means double blowout, where each team is coming off of a point spread result that was more than 14 off the spread, but in opposite directions. One failed, one won. And when an upset occurred in both, a team just got beat as a favorite, a team just won as an underdog. Well, the markets tend to rush into these. They think, okay, something's wrong with Houston, let's adjust against them. Something's right with the Colts, let's adjust on them. Go back and look at Sunday's game. There was no reason to adjust anything. Colts only had 10 first downs against Tennessee. Take away an 80-yard touchdown run by Donald Brown on a broken play. The rest of the game, 207 yards on 50 attempts, a little over 4 yards a play. But they were plus two in turnovers. They got a pick six off of Matt Hasselbeck. The ball bounced their way. Similarly, look at the Carolina-Houston game on Sunday. Houston wins that by 1 full yard per play, but a minus 3 in turnovers. Creates another misleading scoreboard. So, Teddy, do we have one of these classics where they adjusted the game for the wrong reasons?
Quite possibly. I mean, when you think back to the Colts-Titans matchup this past Sunday, the two plays, I mean, there were probably four key plays in the game. You had Tennessee down at the 3-yard line, unable to punch in the touchdown before halftime, had to settle for three, took a 6-3 lead into the break. They score the TD there, they're up by a tutty, and we might be looking at a different type of second half in that ballgame. You had the pick six, Hasselbeck's pick six, which was not a good throw. And then remember, the Colts defense dead last in the NFL at creating turnovers this year. We had the interception that Hasselbeck threw by the other goal line as the Titans were driving to get back in the game. He threw a pick, didn't happen. And then, of course, you mentioned the Donald Brown 80-yard run on a busted play, a play that he easily could have lost 10 instead of gaining 80. So, those four plays, the difference between maybe a 14-point Titans win versus a 14-point Colts win, quite possibly. And let's not forget how bad Indy has been. I got to read off some of these numbers, okay? They lost 34-7 in the first meeting. Wasn't that close. It was 34-0 at halftime of that game. Indy-Houston first time around. Colts at home. Oh, big home field edge for Indy. Let's see. The last three home games prior to last weekend, well, they lost 31-7 to Atlanta. That game wasn't as close as the final score would indicate. The Falcons were up 21-0 at the break and just took their foot off the gas pedal, ran out the clock in the second half. They lost 17-3 to Jacksonville. You know, that horrible, horrible Jacksonville team. That's Colts at home losing there. They lost 27-19 to Carolina. Again, non-competitive affairs for the Colts at home. They just won their game. They're all fat and happy. Now they're playing on a short week. I know I don't want Indy here, Dave.
Let's talk about some of the other dimensions that come into play. It could have been a very deflating loss for Houston against Carolina on Sunday. But what's happened since then? They went home, and on Sunday night, they saw Baltimore lose to San Diego. On Monday night, they saw Pittsburgh lose to San Francisco. What does that mean? That home field advantage and a possible first-round bye still within their grasp. Now, they can take the lead on that this week. By winning on Thursday, they put the pressure on those other teams to have to go out and win on Saturday. So it's sort of like you get that little rebirth in you. You get that little added juice. And take the flip side of this. Why the Colts desperately wanted to get a win. They did not want to go down in history as being the team that had the worst record of all time. But you don't want another win. Because if you get another win, all of a sudden that Andrew Luck draft rights that seemed like a given, they're not a given anymore. So the Colts actually may not want to win another game this year. There's that subtle pressure to not get it done. So because of that, Teddy, what do we do with this one?
We use it as a play of the day, Mr. Malinsky. That's right. Vegas Sports Day play of the day for Tuesday. We're going to get the jump on this number right now. I don't think those 5.5s are going to be there later in the week, certainly not before kickoff. So let's take it right now. Yeah, it's Tuesday. We're going to take the Houston Texans minus 5.5 against Indy, lock it in at the right price right here, and expect to cash our ticket in what, 72 hours? No problem. Sounds like a plan. Texans minus the 5.5. That's the Vegas Sports Day play of the day. And that's going to wrap it up for the Tuesday edition. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to spend with us. For Malinsky, I'm Savransky. Enjoy the games and good luck.